stop being ignorant of the secret world government.
It's all here and all for you, anytime you need it, anywhere you want it. YakYak.com.
Hello, I'm David Ballard, and welcome to Episode 3 of Getting Down to Business on YakYak.com, where we salute the rising stars of alternative capitalism who are making money with businesses based on the green principles of sustainability, conservation of resources, and fair trade. Today, we're going to talk about organic farming in this country and around the world, and how it stacks up against food that is grown conventionally or on so-called factory farms that use petroleum-based pesticides and fertilizers. And when I say factory farms, I'm not just talking about fruits and vegetables. I'm also referring to the meat and dairy industry as well. I'm sure most of you realize by now that the vast majority of cows, chickens, and other animals that we use for meat and dairy products don't spend their days standing around in the sun munching on grass. As a matter of fact, most animals that humans consume as food are forced to live out their wretched lives in what could accurately be described as concentration camps, where they are trapped in tiny boxes that allow them little or no movement, in giant buildings where fluorescent lights burn 24 hours a day. We're also going to investigate the specter of genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, that have started creeping into the food chain basically without anyone's knowledge. And if you don't know what GMOs are, you are going to want to stay tuned because this is a truly frightening development in the history of agriculture that is going to have nothing but disastrous consequences for life on Earth as we know it. Our first guest on GDTB today is Ryan Zinn, the National Campaign Coordinator of the Organic Consumers Association. The OCA is an online and grassroots nonprofit public interest organization campaigning for health, justice, and sustainability. They're the only organization in the U.S. focused exclusively on promoting the views and interests of the nation's estimated 50 million organic and socially responsible consumers. Ryan is going to be joined by Doreen Stabinski of the world-famous ecological activist organization Greenpeace International. Greenpeace has been fighting to preserve and protect the Earth's precious natural resources for over 30 years, and its membership now numbers in the millions. But first, let's take a look at the general state of organic food worldwide. According to the Organic Trade Association, organic farming is practiced in approximately 100 countries throughout the world, with more than 59 million acres under organic management. Australia leads with approximately 25 million acres, Europe has 14 million acres, and of course, North America comes in last with a relatively paltry 4 million acres. And when I say relatively paltry, I'm being charitable, because while 4 million acres sounds like a lot, in actual fact, that is equal to 1/1,000th of the total arable land that is available in the United States. So obviously we've got a long way to go here in the good old US of A. Big surprise. The global market for organic food and drink is now worth around $30 billion, according to the Organic Monitor. And even our own Republican-controlled government admits that organic farming isn't going away. According to the USDA, organic products are now available in nearly 30,000 natural food stores and 75% of conventional grocery stores. And they account for approximately 1 to 2% of total food sales in the U.S. And shockingly, even Walmart, the Darth Vader of American capitalism, has recently announced that it's going to double its offerings of organic products, including produce, dairy, and dry goods. While this may sound like good news, there is concern in the organic farming community that Walmart is going to use its overwhelming market dominance to drive down the prices of organic products produced in this country, meaning once again that the Made in China label will become an all too common sight on organic products sold in the United States. So that's pretty much where the organic food industry stands right now. We're going to be finding out a lot more about it after this brief commercial break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back to Getting Down to Business on YakYak.com.
Hey, this is Desmond. I host Where's the Outrage every Wednesday on YakYak.com. Subscribe to my podcast to hear outrageous celebrity behavior and outlandish public policy.
Okay, welcome back to Getting Down to Business on YakYak.com. Obviously, organic food, factory farming, and GMOs are all very complex issues with good news for our future on planet Earth, as well as a lot of scary possibilities. So to find out more about all of them, let's first go to Ryan Zinn of the Organic Consumers Association and Doreen Stabinski of Greenpeace to find out which is which. Ryan and Doreen, first of all, welcome to Getting Down to Business.
Hi.
Thank you.
Okay. I guess let's do ladies first. Doreen, why don't you give us a brief history of Greenpeace just for the six or seven people on the planet who don't know about it, as well as your position, what you're doing, how you got involved. And then Ryan will go to you and kind of get the same little mini bio.
Sure. So for folks who don't know about Greenpeace, I mean, it's an organization that started in the early 70s with a small group of people who in Western Canada and in British Columbia who were quite worried about the nuclear testing of the U.S. in the Aleutian Islands. And so they were quite involved in the peace movement and quite interested in nonviolent direct action. And what they did was they rented a boat and sort of following Quaker principles of bearing witness against wrongdoing, they took the boat and took themselves and tried to sail into the Aleutian Islands to put themselves in between the nuclear test and the rest of the world. And that's where Greenpeace started. Green because it's an environmental organization, but peace because our roots are very much in sort of the peace movement, and one of our main sort of methods of acting is nonviolent direct action of putting ourselves in between environmental abuses and the people.
Okay. See, I learned something right there. I didn't even really realize that they were doing nuclear testing up near Alaska. That's amazing.
Yep. They were.
Okay.
They were, and it came to a stop soon after that.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good for now, I think, because want to keep moving on with so many topics to discuss. Ryan, why don't you sound off and let us know a little bit about yourself?
I work for the Organic Consumers Association, and the Organic Consumers Association really kind of grew out of the organic standards movement as the USDA began. It's, many, many draft releases of what organic standards would be primarily back in 1998. Literally, hundreds of thousands of people wrote in and protested because at that time the USDA was trying to include things like industrial sewage sludge, genetically engineered food, and irradiated food to be considered certified organic. And then from that, we basically developed into a large national grassroots organization that works on everything from genetic engineering to mad cow to organic standards and factory farms.
Okay, great. I guess let's start with the basics. Ryan, why don't you start us off? And if Doreen, anytime you want to jump in, fine, or vice versa. Basically, what differentiates organic farming from non-organic or conventional farming?
Well, I mean, I think for a lot of people, most would probably recognize the green USDA organic seal that you find on a lot of products on your supermarket shelf or at your natural food store. And basically, as far as the Department of Agriculture is concerned, what they want to do is basically have a list of, excluded things, like you can't use synthetic pesticides or fertilizers, antibiotics, or synthetic colorants, that type of thing, in food production. Which is really kind of a really bare bones perspective in terms of how to look at organic food and farming. For many of us that, are involved in the organic movement prior to the national organic standards being established and really, coming into full effect in the early 2000s, organic really goes beyond that to, talk about like fertility, stewardship, biodiversity, many other factors that are not necessarily included in the national organic standards or under the USD organic seal.
Mm-hmm. And Doreen, as far as Greenpeace is involved, vis-a-vis the bearing witness thing, are there any movements currently going on where you guys will actually go to a conventional farm or try and prevent like GMO crops being planted or anything like that?
Sure, and our tactics vary around the world. Some of the things that we've done recently in Europe, for example, a field trial of genetically engineered, some crop genetically engineered was going to take place in the Netherlands. And what we did was we went in there, and before they were able to sow their genetically engineered seed, we covered the whole field with organic seed so that when their genetically engineered seed was sown and came up, they wouldn't be able to tell their genetically engineered seed from our organic seed. And basically we stopped them being able to do that field trial, at least for the moment.
Wow, that's a great idea. Let's talk about the use of chemical fertilizers. Obviously, humans been around for quite a while. Without chemical fertilizers, we somehow managed to grow food for thousands of years. When and why were chemical fertilizers first used?
Ryan, you want to take
that
one?
Jump in on that. I mean, the best of my understanding is that both chemical fertilizers and synthetic pesticides really grew out of, at least initially, out of both World War I and World War II, where you had both, you had nerve gases and a variety of other synthetics used basically as weapons, and from that point turned into agriculture or farming implements. And then you also had the huge stockpile of a lot of munitions, which could easily be transferred into the fertilizers, synthetic fertilizers. So really, right around the 30s and 40s, you saw a huge boost in synthetic or chemical fertilizers and pesticides. And I guess probably the second step of that would be, thanks to our friends at the Rockefeller Foundation, we got the Green Revolution, which basically created a varieties of crops or hybrids that responded very well to synthetic fertilizers and pesticides and, pumped irrigation, but basically at the loss of biodiversity and, integrated farming systems and organic farming.
Mm-hmm. And I guess if you trace back the fertilizers to the ultimate source, these all pretty much do come from either oil companies or big mining companies that, kind of run the world anyway. So they're just looking for any way possible to get their products out there. Is that a fair statement?
Sure. I mean, you saw the development of the fertilizer, and, Ryan links the fertilizer industry with the pesticide industry. It's true, because after the World Wars, you had this excess capacity. You were able to create all of these chemicals. We had created an industry to create these killing chemicals. And so that excess capacity, sure, that's the thing that industry wanted to do, was to try and create demand for these products that they'd been using for other purposes.
Right. So there was not really any sort of positive intent, like the food wasn't, made better or more nutritious or cheaper. It was just strictly kind of a marketing phenomenon.
I think they justify it by saying that, the food is cheaper. I mean, certainly the food isn't better. We do have cheap food. There's a number of things that contribute to cheap food. But, the creation of an industrial agricultural system, which is monoculture, which is these huge acreages of producing just corn, row of corn after corn after corn, that's definitely facilitated by chemical fertilizers. Whether in the end it's as cheap as we think it is because of all the environmental destruction that accompanies it, that balance sheet is still being added up, right?
Right. Okay, so now we've got a good sort of overview of chemical fertilizers and their origins and the reason for coming into being. Doreen, could you give us sort of the same sort of rundown about GMOs, how that all got started, how they got worked into the modern agricultural system or are being worked in?
Sure. I mean, in the early, in the 70s into the early 80s, scientists were having a good time sort of tinkering around with the DNA, the sort of the information storage molecule of the cell, and figured out that they could move DNA pieces from one organism to another, with the end result being that you could, you know, the first organism was a bacterium that was created, and you moved a gene from one species to another. So the new bacterium was now producing something that it had never produced before. And then, you know, scientists have this way of, you know, if you can do something, well, why don't we just try and do it, rather than sort of asking the question of should we do it? And they just started mixing and matching genes, you know, between species. You know, at some point they started to look at ways to commercially use and profit from their inventions. The scientists sort of left the academy and went into the business world. And realized that agriculture and the patenting laws around, that they could manipulate patenting laws so that it became ultimately very profitable for them to genetically engineer crops, patent those crops, and then sell them to farmers and charge them royalties on those patented crops. And so, you know, they came up with a couple of different traits, characteristics that ended up being profitable for them. There's nowhere near the diversity of applications of genetic engineering that they had predicted 20 years ago. Right now, what we have on the market are basically two different kinds of genetically engineered crops. One is creates crops that are resistant to herbicides, and, you know, lo and behold, the crops that are engineered to be resistant to the same herbicides that the company sells from its, you know, chemical product line, or they've created crops that are resistant to insects using one particular pesticide that they insert right into the crop, and so the crop produces its own pesticide. So, you know, that's sort of the short story of how you got from scientists tinkering around with DNA of organisms to looking for and creating this kind of global market in genetically engineered crops. And I also have to say that there's only a few crops that they've successfully genetically engineered. That's corn, soy, canola, cotton, and papaya.
Okay, so basically they're not trying to branch, or they're not trying, or they can't branch out into every possible fruit and vegetable. Is that the basic idea? Is there some hope for the future that just by biological processes, the whole influx of GMO foods will be sort of curtailed? Is that
They have
close?
A lot of hope that they'll be able to technically do that, and they are doing that. They've met massive consumer rejection around the world, mm-hmm. which is the thing that has stopped them kind of dead in their tracks for the last many years. So they're able to do the same kind of thing in lots of different crops. What they have been much less successful at is trying to come up with other traits that actually work. They haven't gotten very far beyond the herbicide tolerance and insect resistance.
Okay,
traits.
And Ryan, what's the OCA doing as far as, you know, fighting against the influx of GMOs?
Well, we're working actually on a handful of different campaigns right now. Probably the you know, nationally, I would say we're working with Representative Dennis Kucinich, based out of Ohio, to get the labeling on all mandatory labeling on all genetically engineered foods. Right now, if you would go to the supermarket, you would you know, despite the fact that upwards of about 80% of all processed foods probably have some type of genetically engineered ingredient, you would never know simply because there's no labeling on it. So at the national level, we're working really hard to pass legislation that would require the mandatory labeling of all genetically engineered foods and really restore consumer choice so that consumers have an opportunity to differentiate between, you know, conventional food, organic, or, you know, genetically engineered.
Right.
The other thing that we're working on is, you know, across the country over the last couple of years, a handful of counties and cities and townships have begun to pass bans or moratoriums on genetically engineered crops being grown in their counties. And it actually started back in Mendocino County in Northern California back in 2004, where they were the first county in the United States to actually ban genetically engineered crops to be grown in their county. And as a result of that, a handful of other counties in California, including Trinity County, which is up north near the Oregon border, as well as Marin, and most recently Santa Cruz, have all, you know, put in local ordinances that regulate or basically ban genetically engineered crops in their counties. So basically, and as a result of that, and seeing the writing on the wall, biotech companies like Monsanto and the Farm Bureau has basically gone to a lot of the different state legislatures around the country and begun to pass what are called preemption laws. And what that basically means is that no local governing body, like a city or county, can actually regulate seeds, genetically engineered crops, what have you. And so they're now passing laws that would strip away the democratic rights of local cities and counties to do that. And in fact, we're actually in the middle of a big fight right now in California. Senator Dean Flores from the Central Valley is just hasn't introduced a bill last legislative session in 2005, which would basically overturn all of the gains won in counties like Mendocino and Trinity, but also stop further counties from passing any type of laws in the future that would regulate genetically engineered crops.
Okay, well, that sounds like a horror story. What percentage do you think of states right now have actually already passed those sort of preemptive laws?
I think at last count it was 15 states, everything, including Arizona. California, in legislative session right now, it's a possibility after the break in August that the bill will leave the committees of the assembly and actually head to the floor for a vote. A handful of other states like Missouri, as well as Nebraska and North Carolina, have been able to actually stop the bills, though we've actually lost ground in 15 states across the country.
So actually, though, in Nebraska, which is, a huge corn-growing state, they do still allow counties and cities to basically, create their own regulations about this kind of stuff.
At the moment. What happened was there was, a big fear on behalf of the biotech companies as well as the Farm Bureau and industrial ag proponents in general, that, these bans or any type of regulation, be it, genetically engineered foods or factory farms or sometimes that are called concentrated feedlots, basically that local citizens would take control of their destiny and begin to legislate and organize around these issues. So I feel pretty confident now that we've been able to create enough of a groundswell across this country to actually stop some of these laws, but I think we're definitely in for a long haul when it comes to overturning the laws in some of these other states.
No doubt. Okay, we've sort of gone, looked at the negative aspect of the GMOs. Let's take a little turn and go into the positive direction and talk about organic foods and how, and also I actually went to an OCA meeting a few months ago, and one of the ideas that made a big impact on me was the concept of not only buying organic food, because obviously if food is grown organically in Chile, for instance, or Mexico, yeah, it's organic, but then you got to spend, you got to use a lot of oil or some sort of energy to ship it to wherever we are. So could you guys talk about the concept of buying locally grown products and if there's any sort of movement afoot to try and, label product? I mean, everybody knows if something's from a different country, but just is there any sort of movement to get people to, produce and consume food that's grown locally, because that will lower the true cost environmentally, so to speak, of the food? Doreen, why should take that first?
Yeah, I think the local consumption movement is a great growing movement in the United States, and it links so many people and so people working in so many different so many different areas. So, for example, there's a movement called the Farm to School movement, which links farmers with local schools and actually is trying to set in place getting schools to adopt local buying policies so that they can buy food from their local farmer, they can get fresher food, they can support the local economy. And so it's really a community, another way for a community to support the agriculture that is part and parcel of the community. So it's another example of community-supported agriculture, which we usually think of as people just buying shares from farms, from local farms.
Right, or just going to the farmer's market or on Wednesday afternoon here in Santa Monica or something, which is great, yeah. But it's kind of a drop in the bucket when you compare that to the, California school system.
Right, and other institutions, because this doesn't have to be limited to schools,
exactly,
right? You can think about hospitals who ought to be buying fresh local food rather than the, you know, dreadful, unhealthy stuff that you get from large institutional food providers.
Yeah, and actually, since California is the most populous state in the union, Ryan, could you talk about the impact that just if just the state of California adopted those kind of programs, what sort of an impact that would have in general on the economy and on the organic food movement?
Well, I mean, I think you're talking about a lot of different issues here that, you know, the buy local, buy organic movement really encompasses. I mean, right now, I believe in Santa Monica, even LA Unified in Malibu all have farm cafeteria programs. So both you're able to provide institutional support for local and organic farmers and give them a guaranteed market with a set price, which is very important since the market can be really volatile sometimes and there's not a lot of support for organic farmers versus big, you know, conventional and genetically engineered commodity farmers. And so it allows you to actually maintain the dollars within your local community as opposed to, you know, spending it through a major food distributor like Sysco, for example, or Aramark.
Right, because then the farmer...
Also, I mean, one of the,
I'm sorry, I was just thinking, because if the farmer knew he would have a guaranteed market, he could then go to the bank, say, if he needed a loan, and use that as collateral, I guess. I'm just thinking in terms
absolutely.
Of business.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the biggest, I think, you know, ways we can really begin to provide organic food universally, you know, especially for low-income and underserved communities through institutional purchasing. I mean, now they've got farm-to-school programs, farm-to-fraternity programs. They've got quite a few college cafeterias. In California right now, there's a huge campaign with all UC campuses to get, you know, locally sourced organic food into the cafeterias. So I think, you know, there's many benefits. There's many different ways to actually plug into that.
That's great.
And one thing, I mean, is, you know, probably a very common statistic that's cited that the average, you know, food item travels about 1,600 miles, give or take, from farm to fork, you know, and it doesn't really matter if you're buying organic, you know, like you mentioned, organic grapes from Chile. Well, you know, you're really creating many, you know, additional environmental problems to get your organic food in the process. So the idea is to really reorientate the local food market so that it is both organic and you have a direct relationship with the farmers, and the farmers are actually getting paid a fair price.
Okay, great. Doreen, we were talking about how GMO crops are successful only so far, corn, you know, a few other basic staples. How about the, can we look at the flip side of that coin? What are the most successful organically grown crops? You know, what kind of farms are really working well, and what parts of the country are those farms doing best in?
I think if you look at the organic movement, the organic farms across the United States, I mean, I don't think that you can pick any particular region or crop. I mean, it depends on the farmer's skills and their devotion to creating a good organic, you know, healthy product. Because, you know, I live in Maine, and we have a thriving organic farming industry in the northeast of the United States, and you wouldn't necessarily expect that. You know, it's cold. Certainly, we don't have food year-round the way you have it in California, but mm-hmm. I wouldn't necessarily say, you know, California's got a more successful organic movement because of the weather. Now, that said, in California, you can grow an awful lot more crops, and you can grow an awful lot more of them organically. Some crops are easier to grow organic. Some crops are much easier to do that transition from pesticide dependence to using organic production methods. But, you know, good farmers can grow just about anything organic and grow it well.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said earlier, we were doing it for a pretty long time before chemical fertilizers came along. So I guess, you know, it's not that hard.
Yep.
And again, just to kind of look at the contrasting side of things, we all have heard of Monsanto and DuPont, all these giant companies that create chemicals. Are there any companies that are sort of at the forefront of the organic food movement that are, you know, getting bigger, but in a good way, so that there's sort of an anchor that the organic movement can, you know, rely on that won't be going away anytime soon? Ryan, you
want? Well, two you know, examples come to mind, at least some that your listeners might know. I mean, one is pretty common, which is Organic Valley, which is, you know, has actually a co-op of family farms, over 500 farms, and they actually, you know, source regionally. So people in California would get milk that's actually, you know, produced, you know, from California.
Right. Actually, Ryan, I think we had a little weird technical sound there. Can you repeat the name of that company?
That's Organic Valley, and it's actually a cooperative, and they're based out of Wisconsin, but they've got, you know, dairy farmers, you know, really around the country, and they're able to produce regionally, as opposed to having a national brand like Horizon Organic, for example, which pools all most of their milk together and then distributes it from there. So this way you're actually supporting, you know, state or regional farmers through their many, you know, different products. Another, you know, a pretty ethical and quality organic company would be Eden Organics, which I think consistently goes above and beyond the USDA organic label. But really, I think, you know, what you would want to look for as much as possible is to try to source directly through, like Doreen mentioned, with the shares program, like a CSA, or through farmers markets. And one good resource that we use quite a bit is called Local Harvest, and it's localharvest.org. And there you can basically punch in your zip code and find every farmer's market, local farmer, and natural food store in your area, so you can really begin to support those farmers and producers in your area and have begin to create more of a direct relationship with them.
Okay, great. I guess what we're talking about, as well as, you know, the actual organic movement and anti-GMO movement, is to start rethinking the whole process of our system, of the, you know, that's why I call the show Getting Down to Business, because I like to always kind of keep that perspective of real life terms. So what we're talking about is kind of rejiggering the system, as it were, to kind of really make people start thinking away, to start moving away from the concept of having these huge centralized factory farms or whatever, shipping them halfway across the country, to, you know, start thinking in terms of how things used to be, which is, you know, you'd have a local farm or dairy or whatever, and it would just make sense to get your food or whatever, your dairy, from someone nearby, because then it would be fresher, it would be cheaper, because they're not paying for transportation costs. Plus, you know, you might even actually know the people and develop a human relationship with them, which I think can't be bad, you know, for food that you eat. If you know the people that grow it, I think that just makes it that much better.
Yep, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's a good way of describing the reorientation that really does need to take place in our agricultural system for, you know, so many reasons, you know, and you've mentioned some of them, whether it's the transport miles, and as we begin to worry more and more about climate change, as people begin to wake up about climate change, transport miles in their food are going to have meaning for them. It's, you know, the death of the Gulf of Mexico because of all the fertilizers and pesticides that go down the Mississippi and into the Gulf of Mexico. Mean these massive environmental problems that are going to start showing up because of the industrial agricultural system that we've created, we need very much right now. And, you know, there's so much positive positive direction happening within our organic agriculture, within the local agriculture movement, in the direction that we really, really need to head.
Well, I couldn't have said it better myself. Okay, so we've pretty much reached the end of the of episode three here. I'd like to thank you so much for being on the show.
Sure, it was a great opportunity. I was happy to join you and have fun with segment four.
Well, thank you very much, and look forward to having you on the show again. Okay, great. So, all right, so why don't you guys hang in there? We're going to go to another little brief commercial break here. You're listening to Getting Down to Business. I'm David Ballard, and you're on yakyak.com. We'll be right back.
Tired of using those same boring old words every day? Then watch Word Up every Monday and Wednesday from yakyak.com. I'll teach you two intelligent new words every episode and show you fun ways to incorporate them into your vocabulary. Subscribe at yakyak.com or on iTunes and expand your mind in only 6 minutes a week. That's every Monday and Wednesday only from yakyak.com.
Well, that's about all the time we have today for Getting Down to Business. I'd like to thank Ryan Zinn and Doreen Stabinski for being on the show. And remember, if you'd like to find out more about how to increase the amount of organic food in your life and decrease the amount of food you consume that is produced using GMO technology and oil-based fertilizers and pesticides, call the Organic Consumers Association at 218-226-4164 or visit their website at www.organicconsumers.org. If you'd like to join Greenpeace and the fight to prevent greedy, short-sighted humans from destroying what's left of the planet, call them at 202-462-1177 or visit their website at www.greenpeace.org. Until the next time, I'm David Ballard for Getting Down to Business. May all your deals be good.
Time to stop being ignorant of the secret world government.
You've been listening to Getting Down to Business with David Ballard on YakYak.com. Produced by David Ballard and Anna Cortez. Written by David Ballard. Recorded live at the Yak Yak Studios in Santa Monica, California.
Don't believe in what you hear.
What is Yak Yak? Yak Yak is provocative. It's news, information, and educational material. It's sports, lifestyle, politics, entertainment, and provocative, stimulating podcasting. Yak Yak is your life on your time. Audio shows when you want them and where. Whatever floats your boat or tickles your fancy, Yak Yak's got it all for free. YakYak.com. Free your mind on your time.